Ivan Raiklin, are you in the area? Grab him. You're up, Army. Never retired. And pull the microphone down.
Somebody lower the...
Army Special Forces retired Lieutenant Colonel Ivan Raiklin, would you explain your credentials and from where you hail, and then proceed?
Yes, Madam Chairwoman. Everybody can hear me fine? Okay, my name is Ivan Raiklin, as you mentioned. I'm honored to be here. And my background, just before we jump into the discussion, because we're limited on time, I was going to discuss two topics generally. I'm going to condense those. The first topic is titled, as per the flyer, Foreign and Domestic National Security Threats to America's Constitutional Order and Arizona's Electoral System. And I'm also going to touch on briefly the plenary authority that the state legislature has to be able to move forward so that it can then repel these foreign and domestic adversaries to our constitutional order and the electoral system in Arizona.
Okay.
A little bit about my background.
Yeah, pull the mic a little closer and tell us your legal credentials and your military credentials. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. So a little bit about my background. Last 25 years up until August of 2022, which would have been last year. So for 25 years, I spent most of that time in the national security ecosystem, retired as a lieutenant colonel, Green Beret. Bottom line, I spent quite a bit of that time as an intelligence officer at the tactical, operational, strategic level, conducting analysis, counterintelligence, human intelligence across deployed numerous continents, countering ISIS, Taliban, MS-13, Russian aggression, as a military attaché briefly in the Republic of Georgia, and then in leadership positions as a detachment commander in the Special Forces, deployed to Central and South America, and then as a company commander deployed to the Middle East countering ISIS, as I mentioned. So that's kind of the intelligence credentials that I bring to the table. Again, I'm in my personal capacity here today.
And one more thing, just back off about 1 inch and tell us how many languages you speak and what they are.
I'm not sure if it's relevant, but I do speak five languages, four other than English. Had the opportunity, so Russian, Spanish, Arabic, and a little bit of French. And one thing I wanted to note here before I jump into the presentation is the last, I would say, three and a half years, other than focusing in, I haven't really mentioned it, I'm an attorney. So when I wasn't on active status, because I was in guard reserves and active guard and reserve status during that 25-year period, I picked up a law degree focused on national security law and constitutional law. However, amidst that, the last 3.5 years, I was also an adjunct instructor at the Defense Intelligence Agency, where I instructed on critical thinking. And essentially going through the process, and some I'll get into that, going to the process of conducting a professional analytic assessment on a particular intelligence question, okay? And then in my reserve capacity, I spent the last 3 years helping stand up what's known as the Army Reserve's 75th Innovation Command in the Silicon Valley and Greater Bay Area, where my portfolio focused in on tech scouting on behalf of the Army, companies that worked on artificial intelligence, mixed reality, gaming technologies to be able to increase our capacity as a in the national security ecosystem to be able to counter threats, particularly coming from the global leaders in AI, China, the Chinese Communist Party, Russia, and then to a lesser degree, some of the European, what most would consider allies.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Raiklin, really quick on your experience. Where'd you go to law school? What kind of law did you practice? What firm or where and for how long?
Sure. So I went to Touro Law School on Long Island. And as far as, again, it was part-time role. I spent focused on national security. I've done personnel security, helping get folks through the security clearance process to get their security clearance. And then also focused in over the last, I would say the last 2.5 years is where I really focused in. And it's mostly in the legislative ecosystem, advising on, you know, legal theories and the constitutional order. So, for example, I went to, actually last year, I was here speaking with President Karen Fan, advising on, again, the topic that I'm going to be discussing today, the plenary authority. Worked briefly with Justice Gableman in Wisconsin, communicating with the Speaker of the House there last year. And then tangentially also in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Lansing, Michigan briefly. That's probably the preponderance of the work that I've done as it applies to this issue.
Thank you. Proceed.
Okay, thank you for that question. And so that's my background. And I want to focus in on really two components as I go through this. One is, you know, what is going on globally and how it impacts elections in the United States, and specifically, obviously, here in Arizona. But this doesn't have to specifically mean only Arizona. This covers the entire country, but I'll give a couple highlights because Arizona is a border state, obviously has an impact. So just to frame the context, the globe, and again, I've had an opportunity to teach a lot of this stuff, but I'm doing this based on research in my own personal capacity off of that status. Just want to be clear. So there are 193 countries on the planet, according to the United Nations. Five of those countries are United Nations Permanent Security Council members, so they have a little bit more sway in the global order, the United States being one of them, China obviously being another, the United Kingdom, France, Great Britain. Nothing too fancy. But when the world is kind of competing for global dominance, in this instance China, you have to break it down and assess who is doing what and what capacity they have based on four categories, which we talk about, which is their reach globally in the diplomatic space, information ecosystem, military, and then the economic influence. So I argue, again, this is my assessment, and I can provide quite a bit of evidence to support it, but in the interest of time, I'll give you the top level, and I'll hopefully dig deeper in the Q&A period to be able to back up these assessments. The Chinese Communist Party has essentially been coordinating with Russia and being advised by Russia based on their previous experience to do what's known as ideological subversion of the West. So for those that are not aware, there's a video out there back in 1984, a gentleman by the name of Yuri Bezmenov, which was a defector from the KGB, and he articulated in detail exactly what the Soviet Union was doing in order to infiltrate our national institutions, all of them, whether it's education, whether it's in order to be able to influence things, right? I argue that that model was used over the last probably decade plus to work with China, and they have an increased capacity and capability to then apply that at scale in the West to include the United States. Okay, so that's the information landscape. Couple that with the ability to scale that in the tech ecosystem with apps like TikTok. Also having leverage over big tech companies and big media players in the United States. So if you're a big company in the United States and you want to do business in and have access to 1.4 billion people market, you're going to have to play by their rules. And some of those rules are you have to do things like create friction in your own country in order to create this chaos so that China can continue to rise. This is my argument. So what else can they do? We talk about diplomacy. They have a seat at the table on the UN Security Council. They have an influence on staffing the United Nations. We see a lot of these institutions mentioned for those that are following this, whether it's the World Economic Forum, whether it be the WHO. And then we also see the influence that is taking place amongst these big tech and big media actors on, specifically based on the Twitter files releases, of what we were presented over the last 2.5 years, I would argue back to 2018, has been manipulated, curated information that is significantly impacting the voter in their decision-making process. And I argue a lot of it is coming from that relationship between these big players, businesses, big tech, big media, to have access to the Chinese marketplace. And they're advised on how to essentially influence, manipulate, based on the attempted model in 2016 of the Russians. There was a lot of information out there in the court of public opinion claiming that Russia was trying to influence and interfere in the U.S. elections. I'm of the stance, why wouldn't they? They're an adversary. If they weren't trying to, that would be anomalous. And then why wouldn't China do the same? But China has more capability. Now, on the military side of things, why wouldn't China try to influence and diminish the capability of our military without firing a single shot? Well, maybe that's what happened via our social media platforms. By trying to push for a lot of these emergency use authorized products. I'm not going to go into detail on that. I'm just going to leave it at that. Economically, we've kind of touched upon. Now, for in terms of evidence to support it, I try to use the government's own data. So let's take a look. Many people, if you're just watching the news, whatever side of the aisle, it doesn't matter, because the sponsorships matter in determining what content is put out, whether it's left or right. But when you look at supposedly the nonpartisan intelligence community assessment on the origins of COVID, what most people don't know is that there were actually two hypotheses to answer the question of what are the origins of COVID. And one of them is that there was a moderate level of confidence with one element of the intelligence community that the first human infection with SARS-CoV-2 most likely was the result of a laboratory-associated incident, probably involving experimentation, animal handling, or sampling of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. If you were to say that, the DNI's own assessment, what happened to you online? Poof, gone. Would you I don't know about you, but I trust somebody that has a, for example, I'm standing here today. I'm obligated to tell the truth. There are consequences if I don't. If you're watching TV, the people that are speaking on the television, they have no obligation to tell the truth. So then you have to rely on and wait and rack and stack the evidence that is presented to you. This, I would give more weight than anything coming from the television. The reason why I bring this up is it's an assessment that impacted the national conversation that ended up being massively partisan and political. And states need to be cognizant of the global, what's going on globally, to be able to come up with solutions moving forward in the electoral system to protect from this manipulated court of public opinion discussion. Next. I'm going to touch on this briefly because I'm trying to keep this as nonpartisan as possible, and it's difficult because it's a political endeavor to discuss elections. So that's the international component. The other second example I want to use on the international component is, for those that aren't aware, there's an executive order, 13848, and it was passed in 2018. It was executive order under the previous administration. And it talked about how the Director of National Intelligence is obligated within 45 days to give an assessment on whether or not, remember, assessment. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt because we don't know a lot of things. An assessment of whether or not our federal elections were conducted with or without foreign interference. Well, when you start digging deeper and questioning those analysts that provide this information, you get a different picture than what the actual assessment is. The assessment basically says, yeah, there's negligible activity. They talk about a little bit about Russia. They talk a little bit about China to a lesser degree. They talk about Iran and some other non-state actors, Hezbollah, in this discussion. And I'll provide this to you. But when you take a look and see that there was a debate and discussion between the DNI at the time, John Ratcliffe, who disagreed with the assessment of the analyst. Remember, he came out with a publication on January 7th of 2021 that basically gave more weight that there was China interference in the election, but the analysts from the Central Intelligence Agency didn't want to include that evidence that supported that assessment Well, then it begs the next question. Why were they pushing back? And why did they not meet the 45-day window? Well, this is where I got to be careful. In October 19th of 2020, Politico published a list of 51 named and a total of 60, so 9 unnamed, former intelligence professionals. I'll list a few. And a lot of them were former CIA. John Brennan, Jim Clapper, Mike Hayden. I'll stop there. You can go on the list yourself. And then I match it up with the numbers of the 39 individuals that requested the unmasking of a national security advisor to a president. And those names are very congruent. And that unmasking occurred immediately after the 2016 election. You follow me so far? Why is that the case? Are they providing cover for something? I argue absolutely. And I'm not going to mention this book, but you can guess that this is a 650-page book that lists 459 crimes committed by a very senior executive branch member, maybe the most senior currently. So, and I'll leave this for the record. Additionally, the Federal Congress, the Oversight Committee, has also come to an agreement with what's in this report. And they're continuing to investigate. So, when Twitter, for example, says they made a mistake, right? Because the FBI went ahead and said, you must censor this content and you must censor these people. And they do the same thing with Mark Zuckerberg over at Facebook. What do you do as a state to be able to somehow push back against this complete, I would argue, international manipulation we talked about, and then the federal executive branch, I argue at this point, has gotten off completely off the rails. One of the reasons why I retired is because the unconstitutional behavior of our current executive branch, absolutely disgusting. I cannot have any, I do not want to participate in it. I'm trying to come up with a solution within our constitutional framework to be able to push back against it. And that's why I'm gladly here to try and figure out ways to be able to push back against that. So, not only is the FBI doing that with the forced censorship online, which impacts elections, right? But also you have, aside from the digital censorship, I actually, some of you know this, in the audience that I communicated with, I tried to fly down here yesterday. And guess why I wasn't able to get here yesterday and I just literally walked in the door? Because I'm articulating this, those up at the top levels of our executive branch don't like it. It's resonating. So not only did they cancel me personally from being able to communicate these threats and try to mitigate these threats and risks to our constitutional order and the electoral system, they physically placed me on the secondary screening list to try and find something on me while I travel. I'm not the only one. I know there's other people out there. So what do we do as a society? Do we want that? Do we want basically the Chinese Communist Party model applied to our digital ecosystem and where we converse and then be able to be blocked physically from testifying before a joint session here? They did the same thing where I had to miss a hearing in New Hampshire. I don't want that, and that's why I'm here. So, let me give you my assessment. I, and hopefully quite a few of we the people, which are the first three words of the Constitution, of the United States, assess with the highest degree of confidence based on an extensive body of multidisciplinary intelligence that Chinese and to a lesser degree Russian and Iranian intelligence services almost certainly infiltrated, gained influence over, which led to near or full control and I'm not going to name names, I'll provide this for the record, of certain key players within our institutions, our most influential institutions, whether it be in the executive branch, whether it be big tech incumbents, big media, and we have no mechanism to be able to identify and counter that as a society. Why? Because the FBI is responsible for that. And what is the FBI doing? They're focused on participating in that process. So that's why we need to come to a solution. What is that solution? Well, the FBI is not listed in our U.S. Constitution. The legislative body of a state is. So where most people think, oh, the FBI has so much power, they have nothing compared to you. Nothing. You collectively, and then the whole joint session here. And this is where I want to transition real quick. How much time do I have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Perfect. I want to transition to the plenary power that you as a body have. I know many of you know this, but I want to make sure that everybody understands the precedent that the U.S. constitutional framework has as it applies to resolving all these outside pressures, whether it's foreign or domestic, on the state of Arizona and its electoral system. So, 1776, Declaration. I call it United States Beta. 1781, 1.0 comes into place with Articles of Confederation. Granted, there is no federal government during that first period of our American history. Again, 13 colonies transitioned to 13 states, no federal government. It was not until 9 states decided, 3/4 of the states' legislatures agreed and ratified this baby, the U.S. Constitution. What does that mean? That means the state legislatures allowed certain set of rules for the federal government to be bound by and delegated some powers. And those powers that weren't delegated to that federal government, they rest and remain with y'all. And if you don't exercise them, then with y'all, we the people. That's the 10th Amendment, which I skipped. 1787 was when it was ratified, the Constitution. A couple years later, in 1791, the first 10 amendments, Bill of Rights. The most important aspect of this discussion here is the 10th Amendment, and I'll read it. The powers not delegated to the United States, meaning the national federal government, by the document you as a legislative body historically created, nor prohibited by it to the states, meaning if it says the state can't do it, then obviously can't do it because you agreed to that. Those powers are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Okay? Now, judicial and legislative precedent. McPherson versus Blacker, it was a case in 1892 that basically laid out that the legislature has plenary authority. Once again, in 1960, we had a change of electors. In 2000, we had the joint session, it was a select joint committee on the manner of appointment of presidential electors, right before Bush v. Gore was determined. The Florida legislative body, as you're sitting here today, was going to have a conversation on what they were going to do so that they wouldn't miss the opportunity to actually submit their 25 electors to be counted in the presidential election. But before they were able to really do anything, the Supreme Court chimed in. And we all know what happened in 2000. Since then, we've had many electronic systems to be injected into this conversation, which I think previous and maybe next speakers are also going to discuss. So this is not like an unclear term. This is so, it should be so clear, and everybody sitting here needs to understand that you here, folks sitting, have complete authority on how to conduct federal elections. Whether it be the House and Senate, U.S., whether it be the presidential electors. It comes down to political will and courage on how you want to make the frame for it. And I argue, based on what I just discussed briefly here, and I'd be happy to have a conversation further moving forward, what specific methods we need to take in order to mitigate the foreign risk and the risk from an overarching tyrannical federal government so that they do not meddle in the electoral system in Arizona and then obviously other states. So my recommendations. Arizona must reassert their plenary authority, whether it be through a proclamation. I think there's some things that are currently moving forward with that. As a side note, it may be a distraction, but as part of that discussion, I recommend a relook on the 17th Amendment, which is the 17th Amendment was when the power to decide who the U.S. senators are from a state, it rested with the state legislative body. Okay? And then the 17th Amendment changed it to the people. Now, one argument is that if the electoral system is clean, I don't mind it being with the people. But there has to be a mechanism when there's so many shenanigans, as we've seen in the last several elections, there needs to be a serious discussion and debate on whether or not that should be adjusted based on certain criteria. And then the legislature should consider creating a watchdog or counterintelligence capability of its federal officers that are in the state. Bring them in to testify. I'm not sure how it occurred here, but I know that there was a significant assessment that was done in the Phoenix field office of the FBI in 2019. And it discussed a certain letter of the alphabet that was anathema to our order. And I'm going to leave it at that. I'm being vague. The other thing is there's a guy by the name of Elvis Chan that was, his name was released in the Twitter files.
Please conclude your remarks.
10 seconds? Thank you. And so these federal officers, if they're not in D.C., they have a field office. There needs to be oversight and scrutiny and pushback so that they do not conduct what we just saw conducted over the last at least 2 years. With that, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Our first question is from Senator Borelli.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Colonel, I'm retired also, military, and, you know, I'm a bit older than you, so when the Cold Warrior era timeframes in, during the Cold War, you know, the big threat was man, mutually assured destruction. And once that Cold War was, that aspect of mutually assured destruction was quelled because of Ronald Reagan and the wall coming down and stuff like that. And we know about this shift, the change on the concept of warfare changed economically to MED, mutually economic destruction. So that way, if all the components are not playing playing ball with each other, then one of the principles, the other principles will close it down. It's basically a big conglomerate. And so with your assessment of saying that Russia, China, and Iran, all the colluding, coordinating, for example, Russia and, well, actually China wants to be the big economic dog in the park. That's what's kind of driving this, some people call it the shadow government, some we call it the swamp, whatever you want to call it, but globally, this is what we're dealing with, correct? Is that what you say?
Absolutely, if I may. So the reason being is that for China, they're trying to have international relations kind of theory 101 is essentially, as a nation, you first try to create sovereignty. Once you get your house in order, then you try to have influence regionally. And then after that, you want to have global hegemony. And we've, fortunately, over the course of my lifetime, I would argue up until literally January of 21, we were in that pole position as the global leader up until a few years before that in diplomacy and information reach throughout the globe, military capability, and economics. That has shifted over the last several years. Diplomatically, China has more embassies and consulates throughout the world than the United States. So if that's a key indicator, which it is for me, and because they're also a member on the Permanent Security Council, I think the tie break goes at this point to China. And I hate to say that because, like yourself, Senator Borelli, we serve. Same thing with you, Senator Rogers. And so It pains me to say that, but this is exactly what I think is going on. And then information landscape, there really are no privacy laws in China, and they also have 1.4 billion sensors, right? Whoever has one of these or a phone, that's a sensor. And all these different devices, so they feed the big data machine, and then it helps to adjust and increase the capability of their AI systems to move towards from just what we call narrow AI, narrow artificial intelligence, to artificial general intelligence, where they will have a sentient system that can outperform at a minimum any human in any endeavor, and probably humanity in the collective. And so that's what we're facing. It's a national security threat. And so when you have systems, electoral systems, on any machinery, the risk is so great. It's astronomical because you can do it at scale with literally a flip of the switch, especially when you have more supercomputing power, when you have the AI capability. And so I'm not sure we're in a position to counter it in the digital fight at this point. Especially with our national security apparatus that is literally, I laid out, they're working in some instances against the constitutional order.
Follow-up question, Senator Borelli, and then I have a question after that.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Colonel. So electronic systems, computers, stuff like that, I mean, DOD would not allow a motherboard manufactured in China to have a internal mini PCI slot for wireless card and password jumper that allows for the removal of reset bio passwords incorporates the man. We would not allow any of that equipment in DOD, especially in our aircraft, any kind of electronic equipment made in China.
You would hope that that would be the case, but what is the mechanism to make sure that that doesn't happen?
Well, Madam Chair, right. So if we had a computer component, a microchip or something like that in a military aircraft, that aircraft would be downed, correct?
If the federal government wants to do that and doesn't really shore up its supply chain, what do we have? It's really on the state legislature to make sure, especially in the systems that you have plenary power over, to make sure that that risk doesn't even exist.
Well, Madam Chair, point I'm trying to make here is I have an appendix four from sworn affidavits have been filed in several state courts. Country of manufacture or origin of voting system components. It's a list of all this stuff. Like I said, I mentioned that motherboard is the PRC. Wouldn't that be the People's Republic of China?
Absolutely. I've seen that document that you're referring to, Senator Borelli.
Let me see. I
think it's retired Colonel Sean Smith, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
That
yes.
Gave that testimony.
I'm not going to say the name of the company, but these things were final assembly in the People's Republic of China, manufactured in Republic of China. That's one voting system, and then I'm seeing another voting system. All this stuff. Made in China, People's Republic of China. Here's another voting system that we use in Arizona. Same thing. And none of these components, we can't use it in DOD standards for our own aircraft, we shouldn't be, or even our own banking system can be suspect on that. But here's a motherboard. This is all these pieces. We've heard testimony from before from a computer expert says a microchip that you wouldn't even notice if it's already manufactured to do a certain thing. We will never see it, any kind of manipulation through the system. So would you say it's a fair assessment that we should not be using anything made from a country that wants to do us harm should be used in our electronic or our voting system?
Not to be disrespectful, but it is a rhetorical question, sir, in the sense that absolutely not. We do not need to be using that. Every state needs to have a policy that essentially lists and incorporates some of this information. These are the countries that the state of Arizona is not going to allow supply chains within the state of Arizona. Obviously, interstate commerce is a function of the federal government, mm-hmm. but when it comes to within state activity, I think the legislature has full authority to say, you know what, we're not going to have anything from the following state and non-state actors in terms of supply chain.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So I might also point out, I mean, even Joe Biden agrees in his Build Back Better plan, he said, made in America. We need to have components made in America. I think we should do that for our electronic system, voting systems.
I would agree. Yes, sir.
Colonel Raiklin, I have a bill like that, just saying.
Very nice, Madam Chairwoman.
Right? But my question to you, Colonel Raiklin.
Yeah, I think so.
There is speculation out there that COVID, as a tool of asymmetric warfare, succeeded far beyond the CCP's wildest dreams. Would you speak to that?
That's a big question. How much time do I have?
3 minutes.
3 minutes. Okay. So where do I start with this one? So, again, if you're seeking global dominance, and, for example, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, you're producing something which also includes bio warfare capability. One of the hypotheses that I mentioned earlier, I think at least one of the analysts even ventured to say that it may have been an intentional kind of release. I get it. It's only one analyst, so you can't put all credibility on it. But that's still a information gap that we need to dig into further to determine whether that occurred or not. I think more and more evidence in the collective, at least contextually, would lead it leads me in that direction. Whereas initially you were called a whatever name in the book as the worst person in the history of humanity for thinking that. I think nowadays with the Twitter files release, and I believe that the Fauci files will be releasing soon. I think they were supposed to have already been released. We're going to see, I would gather, we're going to see a crime scene never before that we've witnessed in our lifetime that will exactly point us in that direction.
A crime scene in terms of collusion with an enemy?
Yes. As it applies to, I find it hard for myself to label it as what most people call COVID-19. I prefer the term the CCP-19 because it was released in 2019. And I think as more evidence comes out, I believe more people will come to the same conclusion as myself.
And spend 60 seconds on this, how it impacted our elections.
So,
in your view.
It absolutely disrupted the entire legislative plenary authority that was outlined in the Constitution. So when non-legislative actors, such as a Secretary of State, a county clerk, a county, municipal precinct, county, Secretary of State, and even, for example, in Pennsylvania, but as it applies to Arizona, when the election is conducted not in the manner in which this body prescribed procedurally, that is an illegally conducted election. And I spent quite a bit of time, I even wrote a memorandum about this that happened to be retweeted by a consequential figure in our country's political landscape. It saw the light of day everywhere, where essentially when a state does not, when non-legislative actors conduct the election outside of that election law, I argue that it needs to be corrected. And that's for you folks to decide on how that needs to be corrected, whether it's forward-leaning or consequence creation. I have my ideas, but my ideas are probably a little bit too bold, a little bit too aggressive, considering I am a lawyer and a former Green Beret. And I'm saying that bold in terms of in a law offensive manner.
Madam. Thank you. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Madam yes. Chair, Colonel, sir. Thank you for being here today and thank you for your service to our country. I have two questions for you. That book that you have there, you said that lists crimes, is that correct, that has been committed?
So
if you could explain what that book.
In the American legal jurisprudence, a crime is not committed until a court decides that it is a crime. However, as citizens, when you see somebody being murdered in front of you, you can pretty much call it for yourself because you were a witness to it, that crime occurred. It's not a juridical conclusion. But this is essentially showcases 459 crimes alleged with the statute, who committed it. I'll give you a kind of like the framework. When did it occur, where, who committed it, and what statute was violated. And then it goes into the evidence to support that factual evidence.
Follow-up, Madam
Chair. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Colonel. Has information like that been given to attorney generals, state attorney generals?
So you raise a good point, because
and
when you have
a... And
just
say Madam Chair and then Representative Smith. Go ahead.
Madam Chair?
Representative Smith.
Representative
and
Smith.
And then answer him. That way it's on record. Go ahead.
My apologies. Representative Smith, again, when you have a federal captured, when our executive branch, DOJ system, is essentially captured, then the only mechanism really to enforce these is going to be through a state attorney general or a county sheriff that has the courage to make sure that there are consequences for these bad actors. But when that bad actor can easily call that nefarious actor from the federal government to protect them, you have to have bold attorneys general that are willing to take the heat for it, and you have to have a educated class of citizenry that will provide the backing to, whether it be a legislative action or attorney general, to create consequences. Another unconventional way that I think you can create consequences to make sure that lawful behavior is promoted and lawless behavior is, tampered down, is that each state has a sergeant at arms, whether it be on the House side, the Senate side. So when you call your individuals in to testify that you're providing oversight over, I know it's bold and I know it's aggressive, but you need to seriously consider on whether or not that law enforcement official can actually do a detention in the Capitol grounds. I know that hasn't really been done in the past, but we're reaching a point where the lawlessness is so rampant, we have to come up with legal constitutional solutions to be able to temper it.
Sir. Madam Chair, Mr. Ranklin, here in Arizona, our legal structure is a little bit different than most of the other states that you might be used to, because we have been run by Republicans for such a long time. We've developed some cool tools. So although of course the executive branch has the authority to prosecute crimes, and unfortunately is in the wrong hands at the moment, along with the county attorneys, by the way, I should add. In Arizona, every citizen has the authority to bring a civil right of action for violations of Arizona election law. So though that doesn't perhaps deliver justice, in your estimation, are there other ways in which this tool could be used that we're not using it now?
So, Madam Chairwoman, Representative Colodin, did I get it right?
Yes.
Okay. I am a strong proponent of, you can never file enough lawsuits, right? You can never do enough to make sure that there are checks and balances in our system, because as the founders set forth, when we have checks and balances, when there isn't a single party or interest that holds and retains the power, then we have some semblance of kind of normalcy. But once there is no mechanism to enforce things, then we kind of go into a lawless, failed state. And I'm afraid that at the national level, we're inching very close to that. So if that is a mechanism, because again, a lot of these federal actors, I'll go back to what I said, they don't only reside in Washington, D.C., which is that bubble that has that immunity for them because of the leadership, or whether it's California, obviously, right? In Arizona, the citizenry, I think, is kind of on the side of law and order. And I would imagine that, what are there, 14 counties, I believe?
15.
15 counties. I would venture to say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that most of those counties are going to the sheriffs, are going to side with the people to be able to create consequence, especially for those that venture outside of Maricopa into those counties, so that they now have jurisdiction over the individual actors that violated, election law, to include state officials.
The rub is that Maricopa County comprises 65% of the state. Go ahead, Senator Shamp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel, thank you very much for your service. I want to circle back to that fancy little book you have there.
This one?
No. That's the fanciest of them
this
all.
This is the fanciest.
Yes, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
So,
this one?
Yes, that one. As a nurse sitting here, a nurse who is now a state senator because she lost her job and she got mad and she ran for office. Just for a little background.
Was it due to this, ma'am? Madam Chair? Was it because of this?
Partly. Yes, sir. Yes, you called it CCP 19. I like that. So, you started talking about the FBI and Twitter files, and I can speak to the censorship that I was placed under. I can speak to the fact that it is within my scope of practice to discuss prevention and treatment for disease processes. It is my job as a nurse to educate my patients that if you are not feeling well or you would like to make sure that you don't succumb to a simple, let's say, I don't know, rhinovirus that also belongs in the same family as SARS-CoV-2. We have our BMI below 25. We get more than 8 hours of sleep. We take vitamin D. We take vitamin C. As a nurse, I was censored, locked in Facebook jail, thank you, Mr. Zuckerberg, for 30 days for making those statements. So that kind of made my little antenna as a nurse go, wait a minute, why am I not allowed to talk about that? Yes, there is a question here, sir. I asked this question because I want to know, in that book, is there a crime against humanity in there?
In this book, no. However, I pray that the, what they call, the U.S. House of Representatives has created the Coronavirus Subcommittee. And I'm outside of Northern Virginia, so I'm very heavily involved in kind of making sure that we go to the maximum level to create consequence for these people. Okay? Now,
no reaction,
oh, so
please.
Madam Chair?
And I got it, and you don't see this, Colonel Raiklin, but some of you are nodding and that kind of stuff. I do ask for you to, no. No reaction. Thank you. Continue, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Shamp, the consequences that need to be had on this particular subject, you're using the right terminology. I think most of us in here are critical thinkers, did the research early, and that's why we're in the position that we're in the sense that with the active censorship that you faced and many doctors throughout the world, I've been at hearings with Senator Ron Johnson that he led in the Senate. And while previously, because of all that censorship, we were at a position where the preponderance of the non-critical thinkers thought we were wrong, that is changing. The cultural shift and the national shift is taking place as we stand here. And I think eventually, at least I'm going to be involved in making sure that the shorthand version of to answer your question is, that we have a Nuremberg 2.0 style consequence for the bad actors all the way up to and including the person and persons that managed the original White House, what they called Coronavirus Task Force. To me, your party affiliation doesn't matter when your decision-making creates consequences in potentially tens to hundreds of thousands of lives. And I'm referring to Vice President Pence was the Coronavirus Task Force lead, and Jared Kushner was the shadow governor making the decisions. I know that's not popular to say, but I want all heat to come my way. Because if they want to answer to their decisions, please do so in the public.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Go ahead.
I appreciate your frankness, and everything you're discussing is at the federal level. At the state level, is prevention via legislation for future actions such as what happened, is that our only recourse when it comes to crimes against humanity, Nuremberg 2.0, as you called it? How as state legislators do we involve that? Because we know it's tied into the elections. I mean, this is all coming out. So, in your professional opinion, with how you've studied this, what is it that our plenary power is capable of doing moving forward.
So I would, Madam Chairwoman, Senator Schamp, I've seen some examples of this at the state level being done in Florida initially and Texas, where there are consequences created for this censorship by these big tech companies. And what I mean by that is there are probably employees or offices, hopefully in Arizona, of these big tech companies where the legislature has influence and leverage over to create consequences when somebody is censored and whatnot. Okay, that would be one piece of legislation that I would recommend, but it needs to have teeth, right? The other component you asked about, forward versus looking back. If I were sitting up there in your position, I would have already moved in the direction to correct based on the evidence that I've seen, because I get it. I've probably looked at more evidence than 99% of society on these topics, okay? You may have seen more, but I'm just saying in general terms. I always like to go as aggressive, lawful as possible. I know that's a general response, but I want to be delicate so that
I hear you.
We don't use terminology that will override the goals of this discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, may I kind of build on what Senator Schamp said?
Go ahead with a question.
Yes. So the question I have, I actually like to shake the tree and look back a little bit. That's my personality. When you're discussing the electors in an election, you know, we heard a lot that the VP at the time, Pence, couldn't do anything to change that. The legislature couldn't do that. Can we do that still? Is there like a time frame you have to do that within? Is that one of our plenary powers within the Constitution? And how does this tie to the fact that Congress changed the Electoral Count Act right at the end of 2022? Why would they do that?
I'm going to need it, Madam Chairwoman.
Yes. 90 seconds.
Representative Jones, I'm probably the foremost person as it applies to responding to your vice presidential question. I argued in a memo that I tweeted that it was incumbent on the vice president under the Electoral Count Act on December 23rd of 2020 to send back to the states a memorandum to the secretaries of state listing that they had three options, because they transmitted an electoral slate that went against that state's election law. It triggered his required defense of Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2 as a federal officer, providing three options for that state. One, figure it out, abstain, and keep those electors. Number two, hold a new election under the election laws at the time, and then transmit your electors accordingly. And then option three, for the joint session of the legislature of that state to hold a vote and transmit accordingly. I never called on him having unilateral authority to do anything, overturn this, that. 10th Amendment, in my estimation, allows the state legislature to do what it needs to do when it wants to do it, because there is no date limitation in here. And if we go back to the 10th Amendment, if there was a specific date limitation on Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, it would have been written in here, and I don't find it. And so in the absence of it, it's up to this body to decide how to proceed.
Madam Chair, Mr. Anklin.
Yes.
Isn't it true that it doesn't actually matter, or isn't actually really definitive, what slate of electors that the states send to Congress, that Congress has its own plenary authority to decide which slate of electors to accept?
Madam Chairwoman, Representative Colodin, that's a good question. So the claim that the I would beg to slightly differ on that assertion that the federal Congress has plenary authority on the electors. There's a I'll touch upon the Electoral Count Act component. I believe that the Electoral Count Act was amended because the assertion that I made made sense, and they had to shore that up. And then as applies to the federal, so the presidential election process is a function of legislative bodies of the states and the federal Congress. I don't know if I'd have to give it more thought to determine whether or not you're claiming that can they just whimsically decline a slate of electors from a state? Under the previous Electoral Count Act, as long as it went through the process of one senator and one house, and then they had the necessary vote to do so, then I could agree with you on that, that they could decline a state's slate of electors, possibly. But I would have to give it more thought.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Ranklin, isn't it also true that the Electoral Count Act is probably itself unconstitutional since Congress's plenary authority to decide which slate of electors to appoint derives from the U.S. Constitution, which statute cannot override?
I agree with that logic and that analysis. One of the components that I argued was when, hypothetically, we reach a situation where no one has the requisite majority electors, so in this instance below 270, that would trigger a 12th Amendment where the U.S. House votes for the president and the U.S. Senate votes for the vice president, but the House votes one state, one vote by delegation. So the Electoral Count Act does not specify how to vote on the objections, whether it's one person, one vote, where the Speaker of the House rules the day, or whether it's one state, one vote by delegation. And so in the absence of that guidance, I argue you have to fall back on the 12th Amendment, where it specifies in the circumstance when there are not sufficient majority electoral votes for a particular candidate, it goes by delegation. So that may not be answering your specific question, but that's something that I think needs to be brought into the discussion, that the Electoral Count Act, even if you think some components are constitutional, there's still room for interpretation by the majority state delegation chair / speaker of the House on the House side and the presiding officer / vice president / president of the Senate, depending on where they're physically located.
I have a question. I'm not an attorney, as both of you are, but this upcoming U.S. Supreme Court case that's going to be gone over, could you speak to what you think the impact of that, yay or nay, may have on this discussion?
Madam Chairwoman, which, do you know the name of the... You're not referring to the Brunson?
No, not Brunson. Okay. That's dead and gone.
Yeah.
The one that's coming up that speaks to the plenary power of the state legislatures. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case that I believe they accepted, and it would ultimately be decided by June at the latest, right?
Madam Chairwoman, are you asking my assessment on how I think it will develop potentially?
Yes, and its ultimate impact.
Madam Chair, my apologies. Moore v. Harper, of course. I had a blonde moment, even though I have brown hair.
Say again.
Moore v. Harper.
Moore versus Harper.
So I haven't looked at the details of that one specifically, but my assessment, my estimate on what potentially would transpire based on what we've seen over the last several years with the Supreme Court, is that the Supreme Court does not like to take cases that are going to be very politically...
charged.
Not charged. Power shifting is probably the phrase that I would use. Even though the precedent, as I listed, fully grants them and requires them to take some of these cases. I'll use as an example the Pennsylvania versus Texas... Mm-hmm. Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan case. When I saw Attorney General Ken Paxton file that from Texas, that was probably the most compelling case of any case that I had seen during that election cycle. And when in Article 3, when two states are going after each other in a lawsuit, there's no venue other than the Supreme Court. And then when the Supreme Court states that they don't have authority.
Madam Chair, point of information. Mr. Anklin, I think you might be thinking of the different case. The Supreme Court's already granted cert in Moore v. Harper. They are hearing the case. The decision will come in June. This is the one about the independent state legislature doctrine, if that refreshes your recollection.
Okay. If that's the case, I'm going to speak in my personal capacity, Ivan Raiklin, as a non-attorney, to answer this question, if I may, Madam Chair.
Proceed.
This is just Ivan Raiklin exercising my First Amendment. I look at things from a link analysis perspective. So when the Supreme Court, the current Supreme Court Justice, Justice Roberts, is appointed by George Bush, okay, and it is known his proclivities on where he leans and supports politically, I don't see an outcome that many in this room would like to see. It will be forward-leaning if the decision is favorable to the folks in this room. I think that's where it's going to go. The decision will be, oh, yes, the state legislature has a plenary authority pretty much outlined. It's going to use some of the same case law and arguments to support it. And then, but they're probably going to say this only applies in this instance, and then this only, it's going to be very narrowly tailored. And they're going to try to use language that still falls within stare decisis precedents to limit folks to push for going back.
So my final question then, unless another colleague has
But I
one.
Disagree with that.
Understood. You as Mr. Raiklin. In summation then, you would say that we as the state legislature have the plenary power, and what we have now is what we will have in the future, and don't hope for anything more expansive based on upcoming court cases.
The only, Madam Chairwoman, the only limitation that I could possibly give credence to that the opposing side would argue is that when you have set forth rules already in place by a legislative body on how to conduct an election, and then later on it's changed, there's going to be this interaction of potential 14th Amendment. So amendments that came about after the authority granted in Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, which is every amendment.
Understood.
That may have a superseding argument because of the last in time doctrine, where if there's a conflict, a court may decide, and ultimately the Supreme Court may decide, if there's a perceived, argued 14th Amendment violation on somebody's ability to vote, whether it's citizenry, because that's the decision that the legislature decided. That's a hypothetical question that I think that argument would probably be the strongest, and then the courts would have to litigate. We'd have to litigate that in court. But when you're on offense, you don't wait for a court to decide. You act and let the court decide.
Understood.
So that's my stance always.
Thank you,
Madam
and
Chairman.
It's been most enlightening. Any other questions?
I have one question.
Champ, Thank Senator,
you.
Ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Colonel, it's my understanding that you're spending your own time and your own resources investigating and educating. Why?
Loves this country.
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Champ. So it sounds cliche, but at the end of the day, so my parents fled the Soviet Union in the 70s from communism. This one gets emotional. Okay. I see it coming here. Not on my watch.
Amen. Amen. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Raiklin.